Okay, so good morning, everybody. Let's start the first session. So our first speaker is going to be Robert from Durham, who's going to tell us about precision calculations for the LHC.
So let's just check to try and tell you about calculations from the LHC, or at least to try and make the bridge between amplitudes and cross-sections. And as we'll see, that has various stages of complexity. So in brief, we're trying to make the connection between the Lagrangian of the standard model, which already presents some problems because the standard model doesn't have a lot of the nice properties that supersymmetric gauge theories have. It has lots of mass scales, lots of nice features like being requiring renormalization. And we have to go all the way to the events that you see in the pictures below, the ATLAS and CMS events, that don't actually have anything to do with most of the particles in the Lagrangian. Most of the things we see in the experiment are hadrons, large clusters of hadrons, and even things like electrons and photons are actually clusters of electromagnetic energy rather than individual particles. So our goal, our task is quite complicated. Now, of course, this is part of an ongoing research program, a twin attack, if you want, where we're looking for new physics. And the two probes are either to try and do a direct discovery. This is what the LHC is doing right now. We're increasing the energy. We try to have enough energy to produce new particles. And typically, that will involve many particles in the final state, what we could call a high multiplicity final state, so many jets, many Ws, many Zs, these sorts of things. And on the other side, we have the indirect discovery. These are the more the sort of LHCb type of approach, where we make very precise measurements and try and infer the effects of new physics through loop effects. So if you want the high multiplicity and high precision sitting there. And on the theory side, what we understand this in a very simple way. The high multiplicity means lots of legs, and high precision means lots of loops. So we tend to sort of split ourselves into the leg side and the loop side. At the LHC, with forthcoming high run 2 and then the high luminosity run thereafter, these two regions are going to merge. So not only do we have to be able to calculate with a large number of legs, we're also going to have to be able to calculate with a significant number of loops in order to get the precision that we need to compare with the data. And this will come over and over in my talk. So let's say a little bit about the sort of theoretical input that I would like to sort of emphasize. So as we all know, it's vital in making precise perturbative predictions. And here is an example from the pre-LHC days, or the pre-discovery of the Higgs boson. The mass of the top and the mass of the W are two measurable parameters. It can be measured in experiment, and of course they are sensitive to the loop effects of the Higgs. And here is an example of a loop effect of the Higgs. And already, before the Higgs boson was discovered, we knew that it had to live along this very narrow line, and this placed it in conflict or agreement with the observations, allowing more or less space for new physics. So this is the sort of thing that you can get out of an indirect measurement. Theory was not terribly important for the actual discovery, and you can see that here. This is the two-photon mode from CMS, and you see that there's a smoothly falling background, and if you subtract the smoothly falling background, you see a nice little bump or resonance at the place where the Higgs is there. So you absolutely did not need theory. We did not need to calculate this smooth line. You just can just subtract that from the data. On the other hand, in order to interpret the bump as being a Higgs boson, or even the standard model Higgs boson, if it's not just a Higgs boson, requires a severe amount of theoretical input. For example, in terms of computing the Higgs production cross-section, in terms of computing the branching ratio, all of those needed to be calculated so that with the size of the resonance, the number of events inside of the resonance, agreed with what was observed, plus or minus, and that's what told us that it was actually the Higgs boson. And if you want to go further, if you wanted to say, well, the Higgs boson could have been produced by several processes, then you need to be able to disentangle the different processes, whether it's vector boson fusion, gluon fusion, associated production, or from TT bar. If you want to understand that the Higgs decays correctly into the different modes, either into photon-photon, or ZZ, or WW, or tau-tau, or BB bar, then again, you need to have theoretical input in order to disentangle all of those. And the good news is, and you see this in the poster plot here, that everything lines up exactly as the as we would have expected. The Higgs boson couples proportional to mass like it's supposed to, and pretty much all of the decay modes have had, well, you can see that the errors are quite large on some of them, but all of the decay modes have been probed to a greater or lesser extent. This final plot is intrinsically experiment and theory mixed up. If we would come with better theoretical calculations, the experimental measurements would have to change. So the theory plays a very key role in what we see coming out of the experiment. In many places, what is interpreted coming from the experiment is determined by the level of precision that we had theoretically at the time the measurement was made. And that's clearly not a terribly happy thing to say, because it means if we come with better calculations, then the measurements themselves will have to change. So we're looking forward for a way forward from that to make the measurements more independent of the theory. Okay, so why do we care about loop integrals? Well, loop integrals obviously play an intrinsic part in interpretation. I've just mentioned that in extracting the precise information from the precision experiments, and also in making the case for the physics potential of the future high-energy colliders. It's absolutely vital for our field that we're already now thinking to the experiments beyond the LHC. And I'm hoping that during this conference there will be many developments that help us along that road. So let's come back to the LHC. LHC is a QCD machine. It's colliding packets of quarks and gluons together. Everything is to do with QCD. And the strong coupling is not small. Typically alpha strong is 0.12. If you want to be more precise, 0.118. It's not a particularly small number. Running is important. It varies quite significantly over the range of experiments. Events therefore can have high multiplicity. Doesn't cost too much to radiate extra gluons. It doesn't cost too much to radiate extra quark jets. Each parton fragments into a cluster of collimated particles. Okay, that's normal. And the higher order perturbative corrections can be large. And I'll show you several examples where the higher order corrections are significant. And this means that the theoretical uncertainties are also large. If the higher order corrections are large, then you would, the uncertainties that go along with them are also large. Processes are extremely complicated. They involve lots of different energy scales. We can't just say that there is a typical scale. At LEP, we were happy. We could just say, well, the beam energy was the scale. At the Large Hadron Collider, we have anything from essentially the proton mass up to the beam energy. There's very large variation in the scales. Even in a particular process, when we look at W production, we have the mass of the W, which is a fixed scale, and the transverse momentum of the W, which can range from essentially zero GeV all the way to a TeV. Very big variation in scales. And this means that many times we need to resum the large logs. Further problem is this transition between partons and hadrons. We don't have a good model for that. We have some theoretical arguments about it, but we don't have a good model for it. And therefore, this introduces issues like, which model do you use? Are you sensitive to the parameters of the model? Do the things that you really have no idea about make the precision that you've calculated, that you've slaved over in order to calculate two and three loop contributions, are they completely dominated by a model that was basically put in at the last minute just to make contact with the experiment? You have to worry about those. Now, of course, one way to worry about them is to try and find suitable infrared-safe observables where these effects are minimized. And therefore, we worry about things like jet definitions, and that's a problem that's essentially been solved in the last few years. So here is a poster plot from CMS showing the different sorts of cross-sections. So before we look at the little lines over here, let's look at the vertical scale here. There are six orders of magnitude in cross-section. So we're looking at processes that are appearing one in a million compared to processes that themselves are already one in several million. Over here we have processes with the W's plus jets, so as we go down we're basically adding jets. Here we have processes over here with the TT bar, and then the Higgs processes are living out over there. What is the theoretical success on that plot? The theoretical success is that for every error bar, there's usually a line that is the theoretical calculation. So the fact that you see here that this data point and this horizontal line are roughly in agreement tells us that our understanding of this extremely complex environment is reasonably good. And you see everywhere, you see there are certain places where there are limits and other places where the lines and the data points line up very nicely. So what is the basic framework? The basic framework is the QCD improved parton model. The hadronic cross-section is given by a convolution of the partonic cross-sections with the probabilities of finding partons in each of the colliding protons. And this depends on scales. It depends on the factorization scale here, the point at which we've absorbed the initial state collinear singularities into the proton, the parton definitions. And then the hard scattering cross-section depends on both the factorization scale and the renormalization scale. And this is the model that we're using, and oftentimes we forget that this is an approximate formula and that there are 1 over Q squared corrections where Q is some hard scale. And in fact, although we use this factorization formula for every single process that we're studying at the LHC, it's only been proven in very, very few cases. So we have to be careful, if and when new physics shows up, that we're not just seeing some violation of our starting off point. Okay, so where do the theoretical uncertainties, how do we make our theoretical calculations more precise? Well, we have to reduce the uncertainties. And there are 3 main types of these uncertainties. There are the first type, which is what I would call missing higher order uncertainties. And this is because we've truncated the perturbation series. We're not able to calculate to all orders yet. And we often estimate them by varying the scale. So these unphysical scales, the factorization, renormalization scales, have nothing to do with the real world, and therefore our prediction should not really depend on them. But it does, because we truncated the perturbation series. So we estimate these errors by scale variation. And right at the end, I'll come back and talk about this a little bit more. The good news for us is that this is systematically improvable by the inclusion of higher orders. If we want to make more precise calculations, we just work harder on the perturbative series. We go and we calculate next to next leading order or next to next to next leading order. And we can do that as limited only by our own intelligence and strength. There is uncertainties in the input parameters. We cannot calculate the parton distributions from first principles. They affect the cross-sections enormously. If you do not know the parton distributions very well, you cannot calculate the cross-section very well. If you do not know the W mass very well, you cannot, again, calculate the W cross-section very well. So you need to have constraints on these input parameters. And again, this is systematically improvable by better description of the benchmark processes. So you go again, improve your perturbative calculations of things like the W cross-section, and you have a better chance of measuring the W mass that then has an impact in every other process that involves the W. And then finally, the uncertainties in this part on hadron transition. There's 2 parts to this. One is what we call fragmentation or parton shower. And there you're basically making an inclusive process less inclusive, making it more exclusive on the radiated partons. And that you can systematically improve by trying to match or merge the parton shower with the higher order calculations. And at the bottom you have this messy transition between the very low energy partons and the hadrons, which we can do is to model, and then to basically try and tune the parameters to the underlying event. The goal that we've been set by our experimental colleagues is that in the next decade or so, we reduce the theoretical error on pretty much every process by a factor of 2. Okay? That's where they need to go, and they need to do that because the precision experiments of the LHC require it. So why can we not do that? Well, again, I come back to my plot of loops and legs. So again, loops going upwards, legs going on the right-hand side. Why can we not just solve all these problems and calculate to any order? Well, the way I look at this is that there's a sort of complexity that's attached to a process which is roughly given by the number of loops plus the number of lakes. You can be a little bit more clever than that and say, well, it's the number of integrations, so it's 4 times the number of loops plus 3 times the number of lakes. But roughly speaking, it's loops plus lakes. That's this complexity up here. Added to which, there is the extra complexity of adding mass scales into your integrals. If you do a loop integral with everything light-like, everything gets very simple. If you do things with everything with different masses, it suddenly gets very, very hard. The function base that you need to solve those integrals is simply not known at the moment. At the moment, our current standard is, roughly speaking, next to leading order. There are exceptions where people have pushed beyond to next leading order, and we'll come to those, and one or two exceptional cases where people have gone beyond that. But basically speaking, the level where we're at the moment is next to leading order. Okay, so let me just review very quickly what goes into a next to leading order calculation, the current state of the art. So there is always a contribution from a loop diagram, looking something like this. This is just a sample diagram, and an example, a real radiation graph. And as you all know, when you compute a graph like this, there are explicit poles in epsilon to do with this, when the exchange gluons become either soft or collinear. And this they naturally combine with these real radiation graphs that are actually finite in 4 dimensions, but when you integrate them over the unresolved regions of phase space, become divergent. So, for example, if we look in the region of phase space where this gluon here has essentially zero energy, then the final state looks like a three-particle final state, just as here. And when we integrate out this soft singularity, we find the same sort of 1 over epsilon squared divergences that appeared in the virtual graphs. And to get a next to leading order calculation, we have to find some way of combining these two infinite contributions. So it's not enough just to compute the amplitudes here and here. We have to have a way of isolating the infrared singularities. So there are several methods that have been established for these. They've been automated in the last few years, and essentially the combining of the infrared problem has been solved repeatedly, and the bottleneck was calculating these one loop amplitudes. And that also is now a solved problem. And it's a solved problem because of one very special feature. And the feature is that any one loop integral can be written in terms of only a few number of loop integrals. Okay? Every loop integral, however complicated, however many legs, reduces down to only needing to know box integrals, triangle integrals, and bubble integrals. And if you want to make massive particles, then you have to include tadpoles. The higher polygon contributions drop out. Okay? All of these integrals is a finite number. They're all known. They've all been expanded around d equals to 4. So the problem of computing one-loop integrals at some level turns into just working out the coefficients of these integrals. In the past, we would do this very systematically, starting from Feynman diagrams, writing the diagrams down in terms of an integrals, reducing them all in a very arduous way. And the clever parts that came in order to speed that up was to use the ideas of unitarity that came directly from the development from the amplitude background, either through sewing trees together, through freezing the loop momenta out with multiple cuts, reducing the integrand rather than the integral, and then the sort of final coup de grace was this d-dimensional unitarity. And these different methods allowed us basically to automate the production of loop integrals. It still takes CPU time, but the problem itself is closed and can be automated. And there are a whole variety of different tools. There may even be more tools than this, but I've written down the names of 6 tools where you can basically go away and ask for loop integrals to be computed. Of course, anything that can be done on the clever theorist side can also be done a little bit more on the plumber side. So we can use the same sort of ideas to try and build up a more traditional approach, and this is the one loop recursion relation. So unlike in the amplitude side where you're always talking about on-shell recursion, here this is explicitly an off-shell recursion where this leg here is off-shell and at the end you set it on-shell. So this is basically building up vertices or Green's functions as you work all the way through. And here the thing that really cracked it was the recursive construction of the tensor numerator, that's a product of the group in Zurich. And again, this has led to automation. And there are at least two implementations of this. So the one loop problem, the next leading order problem, is essentially solved. And you can go now and look on various people's websites and get a list of all the processes that you can want. This is a list from a couple of years ago, but you can see that you can have things like gamma gamma plus up to 2 jets, gamma plus jets up to 3 jets. If you don't like one person's integrator, you can go away and use somebody else's integrator. And you know, basically it's a well solved problem. Now this had some consequences. The experimenters before this happened were very, very keen to get next to leading order calculations. And they would make us wish lists. Every 2 years there's a meeting at Les Ouches and where the experimenters and theorists join up, and usually at the end of it there's a whole list of wishes from the experimenters that typically involved any sort of final state plus pretty much anything the experimenters could think of. And in 2011 we declared that their wish list was officially complete. So we solved everything the experimenters wanted. And at that point, they were very happy. It took them 2 years before they thought, well, hang on. If NLO is done, surely we should be able to ask for more. And they did. They came back in 2013, and now there is a next-to-next leading order and beyond. So here, what they call the high-precision wish list, where there are, again, 20 or 30 processes where they would like to have things beyond where we are at the moment. And not only do they want them beyond where they are at the moment, but they want them in the same form as the next leading order calculations, because at the end of the day you just add another n, right? What's so hard about that? So this is where we got to. We basically, as at the parton level integrator, we solved the problem. The wish list was done. Now, how do we make the contact better with the experiments? Not quite done. I should say something about electroweak corrections. Everything I said so far was about QCD, but electroweak is essentially the same, although more complicated. You might have thought that electroweak corrections at the LHC were not so big, but it turns out that alpha and alpha strong squared, roughly the same sort of size, right? So alpha is roughly 1%, alpha strong is 10%. There are factors that come in here, but sort of parametrically speaking, you think that next to leading order might actually be as important as the next order in QCD. And that would be true up until the fact that there are certain regions, certain kinematic regions, where there are enhancements. So for example, if you are looking at electrons and you're worried about the photon radiation from electrons, then you find mass singular logs, like the log of the mass of the electron divided by the hard scale, that changes makes very important corrections to the measurement of the electron energy, and this has an important impact on the W mass measurement. If you go to very high energies, then you find that there can be Sudikoff logs. So here, these are large logs; these are essentially infrared logs where the cancellation is spoiled by the spontaneous symmetry breaking, where you find that you have an enhancement here by 1 over sine squared of the weak angle times the squared log of the mass of the W divided by the hard scale. So you can find regions where it's expected that these electroweak contributions, even though they are formally small, can get very large. You also find that there's a change on the parton distributions, because once you worry about electroweak corrections, then you find that you have to worry about the distribution of photons inside of the proton. And then finally, another problem that we really haven't completely got to grips with is that the W and bosons themselves decay. So you have to worry about the fact that they are produced not on shell, but they are produced through a resonance, and the realistic observables have to be defined via the decay products, and you have to worry about these off-shell effects, which are part of the next leading order electroweak corrections. So next to leading order electroweak can be important. How do we even combine them together? And why this is not a completely trivial problem, let me illustrate here. This is just some sample process where we take two gluons and end up with two quarks. So we're thinking about, let's say, dijet production. It's just a reference example. And you can get tree contributions from QCD, so here we go. And you can get other contributions here where there's a vector boson exchanged. So these would be, for example, QQ bar goes to W, goes to QQ bar. That would be a contribution to digest. And you can get interference between the QQ bar QCD graphs and the electroweak graphs. And these are small because they tend to be suppressed. For example, if you interfere this one with this one, you get zero contribution because of color conservation. But if you interfere this one with this one, then you definitely get a contribution. Okay, it's only tree level. We can perhaps sort those out. At the loop level, it gets a little bit more complicated. So here, we've put some loop corrections to a QCD process. So these would be weak corrections to QCD, interfered onto the QCD tree level process. And here is a pure QCD correction that now is interfered with the weak process. So you can see different types of contribution and quite complicated how to add them together. And in particular, when you do you now take the next leading order QCD and add it to the next leading order electroweak? Or should we take, if you like, 1 plus QCD times 1 plus electroweak? Formally it's the same, but it makes a difference at next to next to leading order. So just to give a few examples, it doesn't really matter. The observables don't really matter to you too much, I think. The only point is the shapes of the lines. So what we're seeing here is some process where we make produce a W plus some number of jets, and these are different distributions. What you see is a blue band. Whichever distribution we look at, we see a blue band. The blue band is the leading order result. Okay? You see a green band. The green band is the next to leading order QCD result, which you would expect to be the dominant contribution. Okay? So here we had a blue band. The QCD is up here. It's a significant contribution, 20-30% up. The size of the error is still slightly reduced, but still significant. The sort of salmon-coloured band, that's the electroweak correction. So you would expect it to be small, and at some level it is small at small scales, but when you go into the Sudikoff regime, this is where these large logs of MW over Q are sitting, you can see very large effects. And in fact, you see that if you go out to here, right out here, the QCD corrections are going from the blue line to the green are large and positive. The electroweak corrections going from the green line down to the salmon-coloured line are large and negative. Clearly, that makes it very hard to make a precise calculation there. If you combine the two, that's if you combine the two in adding. If you combine the two in multiplying, then you get this black line. So you again see that the uncertainty in this prescription is very important. Other observables, it's quite different. Here we have the same sort of thing. Leading order is sitting down here. Next leading order sitting there. Electroweak corrections end up being large and positive when you go to high enough scales. So the message is, if you want to explain the whole kinematic region, then electroweak next leading order is also important. Okay, so next leading order. How can we take that into the tools that the experimenters are using to compare with their data? What they don't like is for us to give them a line. They want us to give them a code. We write codes and it has partons in. The experiment doesn't see partons. The experiment sees hadrons. Therefore, it has to be plugged into something that turns the partons into the hadrons. And these are called event simulations. Okay, so I'm just saying the same thing here. Fixed order calculation, we've done what we do. We know how to improve it. We've got our partons in the final state. Everybody here would get the same result if they did the same calculation. Right? There is no ambiguity on the theory side. And then there's the parton shower, which exponentiates the multiple soft radiation, the leading logs. It describes the multiparticle dynamics and jet substructure. It allows the generation of full events because at the end of the day you have multiple partons that you can put into your hadron fragmentation model. And it routinely comes under the names Sherpa, Herwig, and Pythia. It does some things very good. It does the in-jet radiation perfectly. It does the out-of-jet radiation less than perfectly. It cannot account for the hard emissions. And there's been a big effort in the last decade to try and combine these two approaches. Okay? So a jet that's produced by a fixed order calculation will have the right hardness. A jet that is produced by a parton shower will not have the right shape. It will not be hard enough. It will have the right sort of transverse size, but it will not have the right hardness. Can we merge these two together? Can we exploit the fact that the real radiation, the details of the event that come from the parton shower, can we combine that with the right rate, the right normalization that comes from the fixed order calculation, which generally involves the loops? So here's a picture of, I've got three or four pictures here of how that's been done. So if we think about a normal parton shower, we would seed it with some particular leading order matrix element. Okay, so let's say I want to do PP goes to two jets. I would start off with the two to two parton matrix elements. And in the parton shower, I would add soft radiation. So these soft radiation are these leading log jets that I was just talking about. They roughly describe the radiation. They very well describe the radiation inside of the jet. They will give your partonic jet some shape, but they will not be able to successfully tell you about the three jet rate. So in the old days, we would just basically work down this line, and there were many famous examples where searches for BSM physics were completely dominated by seeing jets that were not actually jets because they used one of these leading log parton showers. So in 2001, this was solved. Matrix elements corrections were added, and by adding together series of matrix elements, so these are now hard matrix elements running along like this, adding together hard matrix elements, we always get the hard part of the jet right. We add these showers to get the softer parts of the jet, the more exclusive parts of the event right. And then we have to combine them in such a way that this type of event here doesn't double count this type of event. And that was solved. That goes under the name of CKKW or MLM or matrix element parton shower merging. Now that was good because it allowed us to combine multiple different final states, but it didn't tell us so much about the normalization, because normalization is fixed by the loops. So the next thing was called NLO parton shower matching, where the full next to leading order calculation was added in from the beginning. So now we have the right rate, because it's the full next to leading order rate, and then the parton shower puts in the soft radiation. It doesn't change the rate, but it just changes the distribution of the final state. So this is MC at NLO or Powerhag for the people that know about that. And in the last couple of years, because we have all these extra tools for producing NLO calculations, then we've gone even further. So this is one example which goes under the name of matrix element MENLOPS. So we take that calculation I just talked about, where we get the right NLO rate, and we merge it with a whole sequence of tree level graphs with the extra radiation put in by the parton shower. So this is one of the things that now routinely gets compared with the experiments. And then the final one is to basically what's called MEPS at NLO or UNLOPS, basically take a series of NLO calculations. So in the NLOPS style, and then merge them together in the MEPS style. So now we have the exact normalization here plus radiation, the exact normalization here plus radiation, and like that. And these are the tools that get compared with the LHC data. Now the sad thing is that although we've worked very hard to get precise NLO calculations, the results of these procedures is not unambiguous. So each of you, if you had your own method, would come with a different answer. So we start from something where everybody agrees next to leading order is the right answer, and now we do some process to it that's not that well defined, and we end up with a range of answers. And at the moment, all the experimenters are able to do is to show data with lines generated by different programs, and we're unable to draw any conclusions from it, which is not that satisfactory. It's a problem that will have to be solved in the next year or so. You can also do better. You can try and get to next the leading order apart on shower accuracy in the one or two examples, and here is the example for the Higgs rapidity distribution. If you start with a calculation and allow the normalization to work its way through from a 2-to-1 process, then you can actually generate the rapidity distribution and the PT distribution that reproduces the next-to-next leading order calculation. So these are the sort of steps ahead that need to be made. That's really all NLO. And here's a poster plot for showing of why more precise calculations are needed. So this is Atlas simulation for what they will have running through all the way through to the end of the high luminosity LHC. And the way to understand all these different observables is at the end of each one you see that there's a sort of dotted area. And that dotted area is what happens, or that part of the uncertainty is due to the theoretical calculations. So whenever you see that there is a significant contribution of dots, let's say here, then we know that the theory calculation dominates and we need to make that smaller in order to make a more precise comparison with the experiment. Do you see, for particularly these plus one jet rates here and here, a lot of work needs to be done. And this has led to this revised wish list for theoretical predictions for Higgs processes, vector bosons, or processes with jets. Now, why do we spend our time going to next leading order? Well, the prime reason is that we'll get reduced normalization scale dependence. So this is a plot made by Babis a while ago that shows the rapidity distribution for the Z production at the LHC. This is the scale uncertainty at leading order. This green band is the scale uncertainty at next leading order. And then this very narrow band is the scale uncertainty at next leading order. So the prime reason for doing these sort of calculations is the reduction in the uncertainty as you go to next leading order. It also a little bit better in terms of having more particles in the final state, so the perturbation theory can start to reconstruct the shower, and you get a better matching between a parton leading order jet with a next leading order parton jet to a next leading order parton jet. You have a reduced power correction because you are basically working away the space that's left for power corrections is slightly reduced. You have a better description of transverse momentum because you have more radiation on the incoming legs. So you see that the leading order, we really assume that it's a 2-to-2 scattering where everything travels down the bean axis. At next leading order, the radiation changes the shape of the event and allows us to have a slightly more complicated understanding of the final state. So, what do we have to add in here? Well, there are three different contributions. There's a tree graph, a one-loop graph, and a two-loop graph, as you know very well. And the full cross-section is just given by the sum of them. But, of course, all of them are divergent. All of them have their own divergences in the soft limit, in the collinear limit, in the double soft limit, the soft collinear limit, the triple collinear limit, all sorts of extra complications. And now you have terms here where there are explicit poles and implicit poles when one of the particles is soft. Here we have only the implicit poles, and here we have only the explicit poles. On the amplitude side, there's not so much. There's really not so much. Things like 2-to-1, they are pretty well known. 2-to-2, pretty well known, right? So over the last 15 years or so, amplitudes for massless parton scattering, four-gluon scattering, processes with one off-shell leg, QQ bar to, let's say, vector boson plus jet, or glue goes to Higgs plus jet. Two off-shell legs, or two massive legs, TT bar, basically known mostly, not known completely analytically, some parts only known numerically. Very recent results for two vector bosons, but not so much. 2-to-3, starting to run out of steam, pretty well have run out of steam. Okay, the very first sort of things to think about, 2-to-3, first results for those in 2014. So we need progress, we need contributions, we need ideas, we need methods, we need results. Okay, and we need, we may not need this, but we certainly don't have a basis set of master integrals for all of these different processes. We certainly don't have an efficient way to evaluate all the master integrals. The ways we have now are much more efficient than a few years ago, but they're still not at the point of automation. So this is where you can collectively help us. Another problem is infrared subtraction. Each of those three contributions is infinite. So the common way to do this is to introduce some subtraction term, S, T, and U, let's call them, such that the integral of the subtraction term over this phase space plus the integral of this subtraction term over this phase space plus the integral of this subtraction term over this space adds up to zero. With the further constraint that each of these rows is then finite. So here all the implicit poles are absorbed into the singularity, into the subtraction term, and here all the explicit poles that come from these two terms are rendered explicit and cancel off against the explicit poles in the double virtual. Now we do not have the final answer, let's say. There are several schemes, there are five main methods that have sort of different, you have first generation ones like antenna subtraction, QT subtraction, and then more recent numerical methods like stripper, and then NJET in the subtraction, which is a very recent one from earlier this year. Each of these methods has its advantages and disadvantages. It hasn't cracked the problem in the same way as as we did at next leading order. So for example, if you were asked, well, if you care whether the scheme is analytic, then most of them are analytic. Do they deal with final state coloured particles, i.e. jets? Well, most of them do, but some of them don't. Do they deal with initial state partons correctly? Well, we're colliding protons, so we have to worry about initial state radiation. Not all of them will do that. Is it a local subtraction term? Have we actually just subtracted the singularity at a particular phase space point, or is it in some ways averaged over the whole event? Again, not all of them do that. So we can argue over the details, but for the most part, it's not a completely solved problem, although it's good enough to get results. It's not good enough for automation, it's good enough for results. Okay, so now I just wanted to spend a few minutes on highlights, some of the outstanding results of the last few years. And in particular, I wanted to sort of just say something about this incredible calculation that's been done in Zurich about the Higgs production cross-section at next to next to next to leading order. Okay, so the point here is that the theoretical error is too large compared to the experimental measurements. It dominates the extraction of every parameter of the Higgs boson, and therefore we need to know it better. And the idea here was to try and reduce the cross-section to about 5%, the theoretical error on the cross-section to about 5%. In principle, we should be doing this with a two-loop box with a top quark loop. Okay, that's not known at the moment, as far as I know. It was not known last week. That's a bit of a problem. So we can't do it correctly. We can't do it in the way that we would like to do it. On the other hand, we also know that the Higgs boson is much lighter than the top pair threshold. The top quark's 175 GeV. The top pair threshold is 350 GeV. Higgs boson at 125 GeV is less than that. And in fact, we know that the 1 over MT corrections are known to be small in next to next leading order. So we can work in the effective theory where the top quark is integrated out. And in other words, we work with the Lagrangian where we have the 5-quark QCD Lagrangian and then this extra five-dimensional operator that links the Higgs directly to the gluons. And in this effective theory, all the matrix elements are known, and the real problem is to try and, again, extract the infrared singularities from each of the pieces and combine them together. So here is a sort of... I know this will be talked about later in the week, so I'm just saying a few words about it. So here's the partonic cross-section, and there are two pieces. There's a piece which is called the soft virtual piece, and then another piece which is basically an expansion in terms of this parameter Z. Z is the ratio of the amount of energy supplied to the event versus the amount of energy that's taken away by the Higgs boson mass. So this is an expansion around the threshold, and this is the, if you want, the at threshold correction. So at the order we're looking at, this third order computation, then there are two pieces. There's a delta function piece, and then there's there's a piece that's generated basically by the soft radiation set of plus distributions that are produced by soft gluon emissions. And these are all predictable and in fact known for a long time ago. What's not been known is this coefficient here, the coefficient of the delta function. And this was computed by this group late last year. And then the threshold expansion, you can basically do an expansion around the threshold where you're basically finding out logs of 1 minus z with these coefficients that describe the subleading soft emissions. And this again has been work that's been done very recently. And this is the result, and I've chosen this particular plot to emphasize the scale variation. So this is the cross-section plotted on the side versus the renormalization scale in units of the mass of the Higgs. And what you see is if I knew that this was the right answer, let me just choose one to be the right answer, then at leading order I would get a cross-section down here, which is somewhere around about 12, 13 picobarns. At next leading order, there's an enormous jump up, basically a factor of two or so jump up. At next, the next leading order, there's another jump. And then the next, this N3LO result, again the cross-section jumps up a little bit. So you see that there are significant results as we go in each order. On the other hand, I don't know where I'm supposed to be sitting on this horizontal axis because it's not a physical axis. So usually what we do is we say, well, okay, let's say that between a half and a factor of two about some central scale, that's where we get our uncertainty. So at leading order, that would be between this number, which is maybe 15, all the way through to this number over here, which is maybe 11. So our answer would be 13 plus or minus 2, let's say. And then you play the same game at next leading order, and next leading order, and what you see each time as you go up, these lines are getting flatter and flatter and flatter, and that's a feature of this sort of doing better in the perturbative series. But we still don't really know where we're supposed to be sitting, right? There's still an uncertainty, even though the variation that the change that we get by varying the scale is getting smaller. We still don't really know what the right answer is. Incredible calculation. Well done. Here's a comparison of it with the experimental results. Here is the ATLAS data from the two photon and four lepton channels. This is the pre-calculation best guess. And so here, you have to understand this in two ways. There's a dark part, which is the contribution to the error from not knowing the parton distributions very well. And there's a light blue part, which is the part that comes from what happens if you vary the scale in the way that I was just saying a couple of minutes ago. And when you look at this N3LO result, then the scale variation part has got very, very small, and the dominant error is now the PDFs. And you shouldn't be confused, because we're adding these two things in quadrature, and the fact that this is mostly dark blue just means that the pale blue bit is smaller than the dark blue bit, whereas the other way around. Okay, so it's a big improvement. Data is still very uncertain. Okay. It's going to get a lot better very, very quickly in the next run. Okay, how are we doing for time? 13 minutes. So, okay. So I just wanted to... There have been a lot of calculations in the last, let's say, since 2013. Many, many calculations have started to emerge, some of them partial, some of them more or less complete. I just wanted to say a couple of things, really to try and emphasize the same point as we go through. Why do we want to look at these processes? Well, if we look at a Higgs plus a jet, then it helps us to understand the properties of the Higgs. One of the dominant things that we want to look at is when the Higgs has a large PT, it can decay to BB bar. It's much easier to identify the Higgs to BB bar in those boosted configurations, for example. There's been a bunch of calculations, three independent computations, so it's actually a good place for checking things. And again, you see the same feature that I just showed in the single Higgs case. This is the renormalization scale. This is the leading order, next leading order, next leading order. Always getting flatter and flatter and flatter as you go up in scale, go up in perturbation theory. You see that the jumps, if you knew where the right place was, if you knew that you wanted to sit out here, the correction from leading order to next leading order is very big. From next leading order to next leading order is still sizable. If you knew the right answer for the scale was over here, then we might draw different conclusions. Another one I wanted just to point out was this Higgs production with two jets, the Higgs production from vector boson fusion. So these are W's, and they fuse to make the Higgs, and then the Higgs decays like that. This is the second largest source of Higgs bosons, and it's very special because these jets can be tagged. They tend to be produced very, very forwards, and they can be tagged, so you probe a very particular kinematic region. And because these W's are color neutral, then if you make these jets forward, then in the middle of your detector, there's basically no radiation because these are colorless particles. Here's another feature that most of the Feynman diagrams that you might draw down associated with radiative corrections for this tend to be completely suppressed either by kinematics or by color. And there's been a recent calculation of that by Kachari, Dreher et al., where they've played a game. They've basically taken the two-loop vertices, so we don't ever talk about graphs where radiation goes from this line to this line. It's a very special class of graphs where we only really look at radiation on the top line. By basically taking the previous inclusive calculation, they managed to make it exclusive by including parts of the Higgs plus 3 jet calculation at next leading order. So this is quite a nice result. A nice technique. It's not going to be that widely applicable, I think, but it's a nice technique. And what they see is that by making it more exclusive, by being able to ask more precise questions about the jets, then fewer of the jets pass the special kinematics that we require for vector boson. And therefore the relative corrections are much bigger in the special cuts that you use to identify this type of event compared to the total exclusive calculation that was done previously. It's an interesting piece of work. Okay, improved precision for input parameters. I don't really want to say too much here. I want to sort of end on time, so I'm going to just skip over a whole bunch of other people's calculations, including some recent work that is quite nice. Many of the people in the audience from Zurich, I apologise, but I think I just want to get to the end a little bit quicker. Just to summarise that. There's been an accelerating progress, and there's a whole list, and all of these could have been mentioned and in fact deserve to be mentioned. Mostly 2-2. We have several technologies for doing this, and whenever gluons involved, the contributions can be large. The feature that I want to now pull a hole in this, is the fact that all of them show a reduced scale variation. And that's in principle good. In principle. Okay? And because Babis is a keen basketball player, I wanted to copy something that I saw last week at the summer school in the Higgs Tool Summer School. So this is not Babis. This is a basketball, and this is a basketball hoop. Where is the ball going? Well, we know where we hope it's going, right? So let's just sort of look at this a little bit more and consider the different trajectories. Okay, so what could happen is that the ball could have left the shooter's hand, I suppose, and it could miss like this, and we would say that if there's a big variety in the results, we would say that it was imprecise, because it was basically not reproducible, and if it doesn't go in the hole, in the hoop, then it's not very accurate. Okay, so we would easily classify this as being inaccurate and imprecise. If it would look like this, where the trajectories actually were quite varied, but once in a while it hit the target, then at some level there is some accuracy, but it's not very precise, because if I did it 5 times in a row, I might only get it in once. On the other hand, I could do something like this, where I was actually very, very precise, and I made my prediction, my trajectory was very repeatable, but just wrong. Okay? It would be inaccurate, but it would still be precise. Okay? And of course, what we would like is to be precise and accurate in that that not only do we hit the target every time, but we actually do it repeatedly. Okay? Now the metaphor, where does this come from? Well, in a way, in a way, making a precise calculation like this is us saying, well, the variation, the scale variation, is very small. It makes our calculation precise, but it doesn't necessarily make it accurate. Right? It might be accurate, but it doesn't necessarily make it accurate. It means that the uncertainty that we get by varying our prediction is reduced. Okay? We didn't need to worry about this before, because before leading order, next leading order, we were never at the level of precision where we really cared about the difference between accuracy and precision, but now we do care. Okay? So, how do we fix that? Well, if we are making a precise calculation and we're off by a little bit, then that, from a theoretical point of view, means that there are some missing higher order corrections that we need to add in that will make the prediction more accurate. The missing higher orders. This stands for missing higher orders. And okay, so let's worry about some particular observable. Could be the Higgs cross section, but anyway, some observable that depends on some hard scale. So what we usually do is we work out a perturbative prediction for a part of it that depends on that scale and also depends on a new scale mu. Did it just buzzed to remind me that I should stop? Is that? Yes. Okay. No, it's incredible. Wow. Okay, so there's a piece here which is the bit we've calculated that goes up to, that has some scale dependence, and then this delta is the leftover bits that all the bits we didn't calculate that must have the converse mu dependence in order to make the whole thing mu independent. Okay, and that's what I've written down here, with the bit we've calculated, the bit we didn't calculate. And usually what we do is we estimate the size of this one by varying the scale. Right? That's how we usually do it. We say that we take the maximum value of the bit we have calculated, evaluate it at some range of scales, maybe between mu over r and r times mu, where mu is chosen to be a typical scale by convention. You know, somebody tells you this is a good scale, this is a bad scale, and typically we vary by r equals 2. Purely by convention, right? There is absolutely no reason for doing that other than we all agreed that that's what we would do. So here's an example. It's sort of the same thing again. This is the inclusive cross-section for Higgs production in various orders. Okay, what are we doing here? All this is showing is that the PDFs are not playing a big role in this, because you get the same, essentially the same prediction at leading order, next leading order, and then this is a guesstimate for the higher order terms before they were known. You see that the choice of parton distribution doesn't really make a difference. It's not about the parton distributions. It is about understanding the series as a long-term series. And varying the scale, clearly, you know, if I vary the scale here, it clearly doesn't tell me anything about up there. Ditto, ditto. And the real question is, where is the final answer? If we would be able to go toward orders, are we going up or are we going down? Or, you know, where's the right answer sitting over there? Okay, so people start worrying about this now. And maybe we worried about it a long time ago in principle, but then for a long time we've forgotten it. So we start worrying again. So one thing that people look at is to accelerate the series. You have the first few terms of the series. Can you make some sort of approximate way of guessing how the series goes, guessing the next term in the series, trying to guess where the series converges? You can estimate some of the missing higher orders from the predictable logarithms. So a lot of the logs to do with kinematics, particularly threshold, are predictable, either through soft gluon or the Sudikoff logs, there's log of 1 minus the plus distributions, or through the high energy limit, through the BFKL. Or we can try and say, well, there's a bit that we didn't calculate. Let's try and guess it in terms of some sort of Bayesian statistics. Can we do that in any reasonable way? Okay, and this is the results of doing that. So if you try and play the game in a systematic way, you see that the blue lines, which are the results you get, so it's the same plot as before, but here is the blue lines where we've made some sort of Bayesian guess based on our degree of belief of how convergent the series is. You see now that we have much bigger errors, but at least when we go to higher orders, we're within the errors. This is somehow important, that the predictions as we go to higher order lie within the different errors, as opposed to the scale variation where it doesn't really tell us very much about where we're going. Okay, so my feeling is that pressure is building to get a better estimate of the missing higher orders. Right? If you want to solve the problem for the field, figure out how to estimate these higher orders much better than scale variation. Okay, so just to summarise, where are we at the moment? Well, we've seen a revolution that's established next leading order as the new standard. Previously impossible calculations are now routine and even automated. Lots of standardisation of interfaces, linkage of tools, and take up by the experimental community. Substantial progress in next leading order. I skipped over most of it, but there's been a real lot of progress in the last couple of years. Different approaches for singularities, new calculations. They're not quick, but they're okay. Where are we going? What's the next thing that we have to solve? NNLO automation. Right? As we have the proof of principle examples now, we need to figure out how to do this in a more automated way. That means both automation of two-loop contributions, that's you, automation of infrared subtraction terms, and again, standardization of interfaces and linkage to the existing packages. We have a list to focus our theory attention in the next few years, but we basically have to, our target is to reduce the missing higher order uncertainty, the precision of the calculations by a factor of two. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thanks very much.